This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
Good evening, everybody, and thank you so much for being here with us on Tactics, whether you're joining on YouTube or Facebook or Twitter, Twitch, Periscope, however you're joining us this evening. We certainly appreciate you making us a part of your very busy day and taking time to listen to the program. It means a lot to everybody here on the staff, and by that I mean me. So we do appreciate you, seriously though, joining us for Tactics, where speech isn't violence, tolerance isn't love, and disagreement isn't hate. Now, with tonight's program, there is something that there's a very somber side to it, and well, should be whenever you're dealing with any kind of abuse, especially when it's dealing with children. But as much as I want you to fully understand the story here, I want you to really think about this, because especially when we're talking about things that deal with changing laws or adopting a new law that might alter the criminal justice system, it's always really important to think about the unintended consequences and also think about the purpose behind whatever it is that we're doing. So it's an Alabama man, even though he's being tried in Georgia and the events, his crime allegedly took place in Georgia, it is an Alabama resident, and that's what kind of draws us in to this particular story. So an Alabama man was accused of sexually abusing 17 children at a Georgia boarding school. So obviously it's a boarding school. They have a little bit more opportunity, unfortunately, to be around the kids, you know, because they're not just there when they're at school. They're, of course, also in charge of taking care of them when they're not at school, when they're, you know, in their dormitories or wherever. And so, unfortunately, that is something that the door is kind of open to that a little bit more when you're talking about a boarding school. And this took place at Darlington, I believe is the name of it. Yeah, Darlington School in Rome, Georgia. And the alleged abuser is a guy named Roger Stiefelmeyer, who was a teacher there in the 70s and 80s. Now he resides in Alabama, but even though he was a resident of Georgia then, a resident of Alabama now, these charges, which are several decades old now, are coming back and being tried in Georgia courts. And the Georgia Supreme Court ruled that the case would not be dismissed. So because of the extremely lengthy time period between when the crimes allegedly occurred and now, and also because of course, they're always going to make this case, but because the victim is saying that he didn't do them, that it's a false charge, they tried to get the case thrown out. The Supreme Court in Georgia there said, no, we're going to continue with the case. We are going to hear it out. And they're claiming that the school knew about this and didn't stop it, which of course makes it much more serious. Because as horrible as it is for one student to basically kind of go rogue and sexually abuse kids, I mean, that's the main thing, and that's horrible no matter when it happens or where it happens. What they're alleging now is not only did it happen, but the school allowed it to happen. In other words, the school heard rumors or got wind of it somehow, and they knew that it was going on, or at least was supposedly going on, and refused to look into it or try to stop it. So very serious allegation there, because of course that implicates the entire school, not just that one teacher. And all of this is because there is a new Georgia law called the Hidden Predator Act. So the Hidden Predator Act, for those of you that are not experts on Georgia law, and by the way, I'm saying this as someone who is not an expert on Georgia law either, just like every other state when it comes to things like sexual abuse, sexual assault, rape, even though, so far as I can tell, rape is not being alleged here in this particular case, or at least there was no mention of it made in the story, and I kind of feel like they would if that were the case. Because of that, there is a statute of limitations. And we totally understand why that statute of limitations does exist. You wouldn't want people just all of a sudden arbitrarily calling out a attacker for an attack that happened 30, 40 years ago just to get back at them because they didn't like something. There's obviously a good legal reason for a statute of limitations, and that's why that's always been put there. But this particular law kind of foregoes that. And it allows people to file a claim long after the statute of limitation passes. Now, there are some qualifiers. It does have to be something of this nature where the victim would be more apt to be secretive. And so there are some qualifications there that you can't just willy-nilly forego the statute of limitations in any kind of criminal proceeding. But in this one, specifically dealing with kids, they decided to make a law that allows them to make an exception when it comes to the statute of limitations. So basically, that's the long and short of it. And I know that with a case like this, we don't have a lot of details, and it's rare that I even cover a case like this or talk a lot about it because there's not a lot of opinion to have yet. We haven't seen any evidence. They've just announced that the case is going forward. They have not said that they have not actually had a trial or presented evidence yet. And that's why, for me, I typically don't do stories on this because I don't like to speculate. I like to have facts and then form an opinion on those facts. And so I'm not going to talk about the case itself. What I am more interested in right now, and of course we may revisit this case if the trial comes forward and they find some interesting stuff on this guy, that's a possibility. I'm not saying that I'm unconcerned with the case. But what I'm more concerned with is, this is something that happened in Georgia. Should Alabama adopt similar laws? Because after all, that was what our founders always intended, right? They said that the individual states are laboratories of freedom, to use the terminology used in the Federalist Papers. And so what we're supposed to be doing is seeing other laws that other states are trying and saying, don't like that one, may want to avoid that. We like that one, we may use it. That's actually something that makes a lot of sense when we're comparing to other states, especially when we're talking about our neighbor Georgia, because of how close they are, how they're culturally similar to us. And so things that work for them will probably work similarly for us, and things that won't work for them probably won't. And, you know, you could take that analogy as it, or you can take that that fact, just use it and understand that Georgia is a really good testing ground for a law that might work in Alabama. So I do want to go through some of the pros and cons, and really, I don't have a good answer right here. I'm telling you that up front. I think that there's a good argument to be made for both sides, and so I genuinely want to hear what you have to say. Put it down there in the comments. Let me know. Whether you're on YouTube or Facebook, just go down in the comment section. Let me know what you think. I'd be interested to hear your take on it. But here's the reasons I think a law like this is a good idea. Because before we even get started, every decent person wants sexual predators to go to prison. I don't think that it does any good here to assume that somebody that might have an opinion different than yours on this law, and I'm leaning more towards it being a law, but that person, just because they disagree with you, does not want sexual predators to be punished. I think that's a bad place to start. So I think we're pretty much all in agreement on that. There's a lot of things that are controversial in our current political climate. Going after child sex predators, really not a controversial issue. So I assume that if somebody is for it or against it, they're still wanting the same goal of catching these guys, but they just see whatever happens with the criminal justice system a little differently. So here's the first one that I think it may be a good idea. Sexual abuse victims tend to be very secretive by nature. And without getting into too many details for obvious reasons, this is something that has affected me personally in a lot of ways. Not me saying that I was sexually abused, but people in my inner circle, people that are very close to me, have had this happen and didn't tell anybody for years and years. And I'm talking decades. And so because of this, because it is something that happens so often in secret, and because the victims actually feel ashamed or as though they did something wrong, which is absurd, but I mean, that's how the victim feels. And this is a very common thing, unfortunately, with victims of things like rape and sexual assault. Because of that, because the victim actually has a motive, and this is something that's well documented, psychologists have given papers and talks on this and why they tend to be very secretive and not want to come forward. I think that it makes sense to, if we're going to make a suspension of the statute of limitations, this would be a case where you can make a good case for that being a good idea here, because of the nature of the crime and the nature of the mental state of the victim directly after that crime. It may take them years to work up the courage to even talk about it. And so I understand where they're coming from, at least in this instance. And the second part of that being, it's an especially egregious crime. We do make exceptions when it comes to statute of limitations for egregious crimes. For example, there is no statute of limitation on murder. It doesn't matter if you murdered somebody 70 years ago. If you had that take place and they find out about it, they find evidence to believe that you murdered somebody, they're going to press charges because it's such a egregious crime. It is robbing somebody of their life that they see this as something that the statute of limitations ought not matter. And of course, depending on the severity of the crime, you have a different statute of limitations depending on which one it is. The argument that could be made here is the crime here is so horrible that you may want to make a case that there should be no statute of limitations on it. Now, as horrible as it is to sexually abuse anybody, I could see the point where you would make, if it's an adult, this is something that should not take place because they are an adult, and even though victims, be they adult or be minors, they have a real problem coming forward when allegations like this come out. I understand that. But I think because it's kids and because it takes a more criminally depraved mind to be able to do this to a child, I think that you could make the argument that this is a crime that is so egregious that it at least merits consideration for suspending that statute of limitation for a time, which is what Georgia did with this law. So here are the reasons. Those are the reasons I thought it was a pretty good idea. Those are arguments to be made in favor of passing a law like this that allows you to accuse for a crime much later. Here are the reasons why it may be a very bad idea. First of all, it's very hard to prove anything so long after the fact. Part of the reason the statute of limitations is put into place is because if somebody comes to you, for example, even if it is a truly egregious crime, and say, this person was murdered 45 years ago. Well, as a police officer, you're kind of sitting there like, okay, how do we even begin to investigate that? Surely any evidence that was left behind was destroyed. And that's part of the reason that the statute of limitation is there. It's to keep the police officers from having to expend resources trying to track down crimes that may be really, really old and there would be no evidence to support anymore. And so that's part of the reason that that is put into place. The second one is you could have revenge claims. And when it comes to things like rape, sexual assault, unfortunately, this has become something that's not too uncommon. For example, we've seen this in the media, especially in the era of the Me Too movement, that a woman basically has consensual sex, decides later that she didn't really like it and she wished she hadn't have done it and feels regret, therefore it was rape. Well, no, that's not how that works. And everybody knows my stance on this. I believe in God's definition of sex and marriage, and that means that one man, one woman for life within the confines of marriage, that's the only place where sexual activity is permitted to occur. So you guys know that that's my stance on that, but if we're going to make the standard, the legal standard, consent, well then, if you consented at the time, you can't. The other person couldn't have possibly known that, oh, well, she might regret this later, and therefore I have to watch out for myself legally. No, that can't be the standard that we bring up. If you are going to consent and say consent is the line, and I'm fine with that being the legal line, well, then being two consenting adults doing that, at that point, the deed is done. Whether you enjoyed it or not, whether or not afterward you decide that you regretted that decision, I'm sorry, there's no such thing as a revenge. You can't do a take back on that. You can't withdraw your consent after the action has happened when you consented at the time. The reason that I think that this may not be as effective an argument when it comes to sexual abuse of minors is that a person is not able to consent. And so if you find out later, even if the child, quote unquote, quote unquote, wanted it at the time, doesn't matter. They were underage. They can't consent because they're under the age of 18 or 16, like it is in Alabama, or whatever the age happens to be, depending on your state. The point is, if you are not legally capable of giving consent, then you're much less likely to run into those revenge scenarios because they couldn't have given consent anyway. That's not really a factor anymore. And another thing, when it comes to sexual abuse of children, that's just not something that's much of a consideration anymore, because the child probably all these years later, if they just had a teacher that they didn't like, is not going to go after them decades and decades later because of revenge. Because normally with your teachers, what happens is you know them for a year, and then when your year's up and you no longer have them for a teacher, you just don't spend any time around them. And so 20, 30 years later, you have no incentive to invoke some kind of revenge on them. There's really no motivation for that. And so that's why I think that this argument is not, you know, invalidated or anything. But I think that you can make a much less strong case for revenge being a factor when it comes to sexual abuse of minors than you could just, you know, if you were in the Me Too movement and said, believe all women. Well, you know, that's completely different, because the motivation is not really there, and because you couldn't have given consent anyway, so it would be hard to say, well, what happened is they later on withdrew consent. Well, no, they couldn't give consent in the first place. And the third reason I think that this could be a really bad idea is there have been cases with multiple accusers that turned out to be false. Even when we're talking about cases where there were a lot of accusers. Now, granted, 17 is a lot more than even normal, and so that makes this case somewhat unique. But I'm talking about generally. There have been cases where there have been multiple women, 3, 4, 5, 6, that all accused, and then when they looked into the claims, they found out, well, there was really nothing to them. Now, again, just like the revenge thing, I think that there's a little bit less likely for that to happen when it comes to this, but it could. And you also have the leader effect, unfortunately, where one person comes out and claims that there was some kind of sexual abuse, and then all of a sudden a whole bunch of former students jump out of the woodwork. But here's the reason that that's so tricky. We would expect that to happen if they were making it up. We would also expect that to happen if they're not making it up. Because if it really happened, there's a very good chance that this person abused more than just one student. Or just more than just one victim. It doesn't necessarily have to be at a school, even though it sometimes is. And so, really, that's not an indication of the truthfulness or the falseness of these claims. And that's the reason that it gets so scary when it comes to things like this. Is that even if they're 100% right in telling the truth, you would expect exactly the same reaction. In other words, more people to follow after the initial allegation, whether it's true or not. And then you also have, and this is also another scary part of this, you also have sometimes, even if the allegation is true, you might have a couple people that jump onto the case and say, no, they sexually abused me too when they didn't. And this is the reason that the Me Too movement it has been dangerous in some ways, done some good things as well, but it's dangerous in some ways because what we've seen is, even when the allegations have some merit to them, there will be people that sort of jump on later and make a claim that something happened when in fact they were just jumping on because somebody else jumped on and nothing actually happened to them, even though it did happen to the initial victim. And so it's really, really hard to parse through all this stuff. But because this is a really difficult decision to make, because this is a really difficult situation that we're trying to deal with and answer, I think that's actually the reason that I think that it takes very careful contemplation on whether or not Alabama would want to pass something similar to this. You see, I'm not sure what the correct answer is. I'm really not. But I am glad, and I do take solace in the fact, that regardless of what we decide as the state of Alabama or as society in general, or whether or not a man that was guilty goes free, I do take solace in the fact that justice does not rest forever. That at some point, these people will face their maker, and justice will be served then. I'm not saying that we don't do the best that we can to serve justice here on earth. I'm not suggesting that in the least. I'm just saying that I do take comfort knowing that my Heavenly Father is going to serve justice to these monsters that hurt little kids one day. Now, in other local news, a former governor of ours, Don Siegelman, has come to do a interview about his book on the Jeff Poor Show on WVNN. That's one of our sister stations up in Huntsville. And he actually has predicted that the candidate for the Republicans is going to be none other than Judge Roy Moore. Now, you may remember, and I've done segments on this before, Roy Moore has some kind of weird immortal streak. And for whatever reason, just when you think, oh, that's the end for Roy Moore, he's just going to ride off on his horse into the sunset, somehow he always comes back. And maybe Don Siegelman's right about this. I really thought that Moore had no chance when he ran the last time for Senate. But Siegelman comes back, and I'll just read some of the words that he said himself. One quote that was taken from that interview. Frankly, I think Jeff is in trouble. He is being branded and has been branded as by some Trump supporters as a traitor to Trump, someone who has turned his back on Trump. Whether that's just in Trump's mind or in all the voters' minds, it doesn't matter. I think it has hurt him. All right, so far on his analysis, I don't find anything that I disagree with. Unfortunately, I've seen this firsthand that an awful lot of people who used to be Sessions supporters now, because he got into a tiff, which was by no means his fault, with President Trump. I mean, when you mess with the orange god, you get the people coming out shouting blasphemy. And because of this, I do think that there is at least a portion of Alabama's voting base that sees any offense against Trump as an unforgivable sin, and they will never vote for that person again. I think that Siegelman is correct in that analysis. Now, how many of those people are out there, I'm not 100% sure, but I've got to tell you, it's not a small portion of the population. I have heard many, many people reflect a very anti-Jeff Sessions sentiment. But regardless of whether you stand on that, I do think that Siegelman's analysis is pretty fair thus far. There's going to be a couple of things that he says in this interview, though, that I disagree with, and I'll try to break that down and tell you where he gets it right, where he gets it wrong, after I read the second part. This is Siegelman talking again. I do know this. Most of Donald Trump's voters were evangelical. I do know the constitutional amendment that passed in 2018 requiring that the Ten Commandments be posted in every public place received over 1 million votes in Alabama. And I do know that Roy Moore is branded as the Ten Commandments judge. I think Roy Moore has a silent Christian vote that is huge, and I think that they're going to come out and vote for him. This was a guy that gave up his seat on the Supreme Court because of his belief that the Ten Commandments. And you know, say what you want about Roy Moore, I think he has got a strong base. Okay, so there's a couple things that he's 100% right on. First of all, he's right about there being a strong evangelical core in Alabama. I mean, that's, you barely even have to say that that is correct, because in Alabama, it's so incredibly obvious. Where your evangelicals are probably going to be anywhere from 15 to 20% of the country nationwide, in Alabama, it's like closer to 30, 40%. I mean, there's just a massive swath of evangelicals in Alabama. And it is impossible to win without that evangelical vote, or at least a portion of it. And so I think that Siegelman actually is correct on that. I think that he's right that Moore has a freakishly devoted base. And a lot of those people also happen to be evangelicals. I think that he's confusing that a little bit in that all evangelicals are Roy Moore supporters, because I know a lot of evangelicals that don't really like Moore and didn't really like him in the last election either. So I think that he's conflating a couple of things there that ought not be conflated. But I do think that he's sort of on the right track. I will say this, though. One thing that I did made me chuckle a little bit is where he said earlier there that he has a really silent base. No, Roy Moore doesn't have a silent base. He has a base. I agree with him on that. I think that Moore does have a strong, freakishly loyal base, but they ain't silent. I'm telling you right now. A lot of those people, they are as loud and opinionated and will jump at any opportunity to tell you about how much they like Roy Moore. Now, maybe there is a silent base that I'm not aware of, and I mean, you know, who could blame you? They happen to be silent. But as a general rule, the Roy Moore supporters that I've run into, be they Republican, Democrat, and yes, he actually does have I wouldn't say a ton, but a decent amount of Democrat followers that just like his stance on things like the Ten Commandments. I got to tell you, they ain't silent. You could say a lot of things about Roy Moore's bass. I don't think Silent is one of them. So Siegelman mischaracterizing that, I believe. And just because a lot of those people happen to be evangelicals, there is an assumption that all evangelical voters are going to be in the Roy Moore camp. This is one of the reasons that a lot of students of modern politics, and I'm going to try really hard not to get too far inside baseball here, but a lot of the people who study modern politics get it wrong, especially when it comes to evangelicals, because evangelicals tend to vote as a homogenous block, but only during a general election. So when you're talking about evangelicals, they do tend to all vote the same way, but not in a primary. That's in general true when you're getting a Democrat versus a Republican. They tend to always pull the lever for the Democrat, the Republican. But when it comes to the primaries, they tend to be kind of scattered. And without going too much into detail, the Barna Group did a study into why that is, and they determined that only about 6% of the population are what they refer to as true evangelicals, and the others kind of claim evangelical. They self-identify as evangelical, but the truth is their lifestyle, their belief system is really not much different than other white voters that don't claim evangelical status. So that's a fascinating study, and I'm, you know, more than welcome to revisit it and go into more detail a little bit later. But for right now, suffice it to say that one of the things that Siegelman is messing up on here is he makes a mistake that a lot of politicians make in thinking that evangelicals are just a single solid voting block when it comes to Republican primaries. Experience has shown us that it is not. But he is also right that a lot of those people that he's talking about, the people in the Roy Moore base and the people in the evangelical base, he's also right that a lot of those people voted for Trump. So Don Siegelman, to his credit, you know, I think that he's a terrible guy and was a terrible governor, but I do think that he's an astute observer of politics. And so I wouldn't discount what he's saying here lightly, but there's a lot here that he gets right. Now I'm going to tell you where I think that he goes a little off the rails here. First of all, he's completely ignoring the fact that Trump has denounced both of them. You see, in this analysis, Siegelman acts as though that Roy Moore is going to win because Donald Trump had a very public spat with him. And I think that that did hurt Sessions. Like I said, I agreed with that analysis that he started out with. But what he's ignoring here is that Trump also doesn't like Roy Moore. Trump has tweeted about Roy Moore, demeaning him. He has talked about how Roy Moore is a loser and how the Republicans in Alabama would be stupid to vote for him again. That's all, of course, a paraphrase. But Don Jr. has essentially said exactly the same thing. And you'll remember that after Trump said that about Roy Moore, his poll numbers started to plummet. I do not think that was a coincidence. And so what Siegelman is kind of ignoring here is that Roy Moore has also been bashed by the president. And the president has also said that he does not support Roy Moore's candidacy, just like he wouldn't support Jeff Sessions' candidacy. And so I see the two of them as kind of on equal footing when it comes to their status with Trump. Now, granted, the spat with Sessions took a lot longer. It was on a much larger stage because it happened on the national stage. So I think people are more aware of it, and it politically hurt Sessions more than it hurt Moore. But my overall point is, let's not pretend as though Roy Moore is the Donald Trump candidate, because while that may have been true in the last election after he endorsed him, that seems to no longer be the case. And because of that, I think that Siegelman is kind of ignoring that when he makes that suggestion. And he's also ignoring that many of those evangelicals blame Roy Moore for Doug Jones. They look at Roy Moore and say, this guy couldn't pull it out at the end, and that's the reason that we got Doug Jones, who is a nightmare of a senator. And because they do blame him for that, I think that the voters of Alabama, combined with several of the other factors that caused him to lose the first election in the first place, that they're going to look at Roy Moore and say, no thanks, we'll go with somebody else. I'm not saying that Siegelman's analysis is way, way off, but I think he's ignoring those two really important points of Trump having denounced both Roy and Sessions, and that he's also ignoring that a lot of those evangelicals, they still kind of hold a grudge against Moore because Moore is kind of the reason that Doug Jones is in office right now. I mean, virtually any other Republican candidate. Now, granted, a lot of weird stuff had to happen for Roy Moore to lose that seat. But virtually any other Republican in the state runs against Doug Jones and they win handedly. Roy Moore was the only one that was even capable of screwing that up, it seems like. And a lot of those voters feel the same way, and I just don't think a lot of them are going to pull the lever for Moore. Now, you ask me that, what was it, about 3-4 months ago when he was leading in the polls? Maybe I'd give you a different answer. But I think Trump coming out and publicly throwing shade on Roy Moore really made a difference. And because of that, I think that he's really missing the ball here. So let's remember, too, that Doug Jones getting elected definitely took a perfect storm. I mean, every single thing had to go exactly right for Doug Jones to be able to eke out barely beating Roy Moore in the last election. That is true. But we also have to remember that the perfect storm had to happen, and part of that perfect storm that we're talking about was Roy Moore being his opponent. And the reason that Roy Moore was his opponent is because a perfect storm kind of had to happen for Roy Moore to be the nominee as well. Because you'll remember that what happened is we had Big Luther, who was seen as being corrupt, as taking a deal and taking that fancy Senate job so that the governor could not face the attorney general's wrath when it comes to his affair with, you know, his assistant or secretary or whatever they called her at the time. To avoid facing any consequences for his affair with Mason, he got rid of Big Luther Strange by promoting him to the Senate. Now, again, we can't prove that that happened, but the whole thing stunk and the Alabama voters didn't trust it. But the Washington establishment really wanted Luther Strange. And so what they did was they attacked the guy that they felt was the biggest threat to Luther Strange, because Roy Moore was doing well in the polls and Luther Strange was basically neck and neck with him. So they tried to take out Mo Brooks so that Luther could get in that runoff, and they figured if that runoff happened, well, then it'd be fine and Luther would, of course, win the runoff. Now, I don't have to give you a rundown of everything that happened, but essentially what happened is that, long story short, Mitch McConnell ran constant attack ads against Mo Brooks to allow Luther to rise in the polls, calling Mo Brooks anti-Trump and anti-border wall and calling him a liberal, which is absurd. He's far more conservative than either of the other two that he was running against, Roy Moore or Luther Strange. But anyway, that strategy worked, and Luther Strange wound up in the spot against Roy Moore. The problem is Mitch McConnell did not count on Roy Moore winning that runoff. And so that perfect storm had to happen for Roy Moore to be the nominee. I'm not saying that he wouldn't have won it any other way. I'm saying that let's not pretend as though this just went off the way that it would have otherwise. I think that there's a very good chance that we're talking about Senator Mo Brooks, were it not for Mitch McConnell sinking millions and millions of dollars into that race. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. We'll never know. But if we keep that in mind, that was a perfect storm as well, I think that it puts into perspective how difficult a road to the nomination Roy Moore has. An even more difficult one than last time, where he had all this help, because, I don't know, maybe we see Mitch McConnell look at either Bradley Byrne or Jeff Sessions, who's now entered the race, and says, you know what, I'd really like that guy. And so he puts millions of dollars into attacking somebody else. History repeats itself, and they wind up in a runoff with somebody that's very damaged, and Roy Moore winds up taking it. I don't know. I guess it's possible. But I just don't see that playing out exactly the way that it did the last time. Usually lightning does not strike twice, and that's true even politically. So I could be wrong here, but I think the fact that he's forgetting all of that really helps skew his analysis into a place to where it's not reliable. And before we go to a break, I do want to leave you with this thought. If Trump is your central issue, in other words, the approval from Trump and the guy who you're voting for approving Trump is the number one thing for you, and a lot of people would never admit this, but the truth is that's actually what they think. They use Trump as a litmus test, how much you support Trump. They equate that to supporting conservatism. And so because of that, they're going to look at that, and if they're going to just vote for whoever's the most pro-Trump, I think you got to go with Tommy Tuberville. I mean, Roy Moore had a very public spat with Donald Trump. Jeff Sessions had an even bigger public spat with Donald Trump. You've got Bradley Byrne, who they're going to be able to claim is anti-Trump because he does occasionally vote against or not vote with the president, even though the overwhelming majority of the time that he does. I mean, he was at the Alabama-LSU game with him last weekend. So overwhelmingly, he's pro-Trump, but you could at least make the case. And a lot of these Trump loyalists, that loyalty to Trump is the only thing they care about, they're going to look at that and say, I want somebody that just everything Trump does, they approve of. Well, if that's the case, Tommy Tuberville's your guy. Tommy Tuberville has specifically marketed himself in this campaign as basically, I'll do whatever Trump wants me to do. And as frustrating as that is, let's be honest, in this state, it's probably not a bad strategy. So if you're going to account for this being pro-Trump vote being the main thing, if that's going to be your main issue, I think Tommy Tuberville probably winds up being your guy. And so it's interesting to me that Siegelman seems to say that there's going to be a large base of people that loyalty to Trump is the only thing they care about, and then completely ignoring the guy that is most likely to garner that vote in that calculation. It just seems odd to me. Now, maybe I'm wrong, maybe he's wrong. We don't know. We'll find out on Election Day. But right now, I think that that's the most compelling case, that if you're going to be in the pro-Trump bandwagon, if that's going to be your primary concern, Tommy Tuberville is probably your guy. All right, so we're going to go to a break, and we'll be back in just a minute.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
Now, you messed it up. You're stupid.
And for today's Daily Dose of Stupid, it pains me, and I'm not being sarcastic or doing this for effect, I'm being 100% sincere, it pains me to say this, but today's Daily Dose of Stupid comes from the state of Kentucky. Now, you guys know how much I love my home state. I'm an Alabama boy through and through, born and bred, but Kentucky is my second home, and that's because my grandparents live up there, my mother's side of the family all live up there. When it comes to football games or really anything for that matter, I always pull for Auburn first, Kentucky second, because, of course, if Auburn's ever playing Kentucky, I always pull for Auburn. But when it comes to that, I have a soft spot in my heart for Kentucky, and I've gone there at least once, usually two or three times a year to visit family. So I love the state. I love Rand Paul, who, of course, is a Kentuckian as well. But this time, Kentucky, I'm sorry, you're going to be the subject of today's Daily Dose of Stupid, because how on earth could you not reelect Matt Bevin? I mean, looking at the job that Matt Bevin has done, he's one of the only conservatives out there, one of the only real conservatives out there. And this guy, I mean, he is absolutely phenomenal. He actually, when he says, my plan is to cut the budget, the crazy thing is he actually cuts the budget. When he says that I'm going to try to lower taxes and lower government spending, he actually tries to do it. And it just amazes me that he is one of the, Kentucky has seen incredible economic growth under him. They've actually started to get their budget at least somewhat under control. The fact that he was refusing to sign certain things into law and that he was refusing a lot of their spending measures was actually getting the budget somewhat manageable. And when he's halfway through the job, they let him go for a guy that is just an absolute nightmare from every conceivable standpoint. And what shocks me there is not even so much that Matt Bevin didn't get reelected, because he's in my opinion, the best governor in the country. That he got reelected, or he wound up not getting reelected, and granted, it was a narrow margin, it was only about 5,000 votes, but the guy loses his job despite the fact that Governor Kay Ivey is still in office? That just blows my mind. That Matt Bevin can't get reelected as governor, and Kay Ivey gets reelected governor overwhelmingly. It's not even close. And I'm not talking about necessarily because she was against Walt Maddox, because I know that Walt Maddox would have gotten beaten by any Republican that won in that primary. But my point is, Kay Ivey was running against, I would say, two very conservative people and one that's pretty conservative, more conservative than she is. She was the least conservative person in that race. And somehow, and keep in mind, this is the same Kay Ivey that opened the floodgates for corruption when it came to the economic developer title that makes you immune to all lobbyist laws. She's also the person that was behind, really, it was her brainchild to do the Mobile Bay Bridge that was going to cost literally $2.1 billion. And despite the fact that it had, that they had just raised our gas taxes by over 40%, they were also going to include a $6 toll each way on the bridge. I mean, you just stack up and look at what Kay Ivey has done. She was the one that pushed for and was one of the main forces behind the Amazon tax. I mean, just goes on and on and on. Somebody that has promised over and over and over again, oh, I'm a conservative, I'm going to cut taxes, I'm going to cut spending. All she does is pass spending measures and push for more of them. There is, I mean, other than some social issues, for example, she's really good at being pro-life. I'll give her that one. But you're talking about economically, Kay Ivey isn't even close to a conservative. Matt Bevin's one of the only governors in the entire country that actually is, and somehow that guy loses his job, and Kay Ivey is the most popular governor in the country. That world doesn't even make sense to me. And I know it's because the average person doesn't pay a whole lot of attention to it, and the average voter is horribly uninformed. But I can't make heads or tails of that. How do you get rid of Matt Bevin? But that's the world we're living in. I'm sorry, Kentucky, you screwed that one up. Although I will say, if you're looking for how this was done, teachers' unions sunk just millions into this campaign. And you could make the case that if you want to cut school spending, that you hate children, and that's exactly the case that they made. They had teacher strikes that were going on under Matt Bevin's supervision, and Kentucky does not spend an exorbitant amount on schooling, but they're not spending the least, and they actually have a pretty good education system despite having better schools than they do their pay. Like, if you were to compare how much they're spending per student and look at that compared to where they rank amongst the states on their education system, they actually are doing much more with less money, and that's in part thanks to Matt Bevin. But this idea that, well, if you really want the kids to get a good education, if you really love the children, then all you have to do is spend more money on education, I'm sorry, that's a load of crap. For example, New York is the state that spends the most per child on education. So remember, this is per child, so it's adjusted for population. And yet, they rank 22nd amongst the states in quality of education. Now, 22nd isn't terrible. Let's be honest, it ain't exactly doing all that well either. And then you contrast that to Utah, which spends by a great length the least amount per student, and they're ranked 10th. The idea that how much you spend per child or how much you're spending on your education system directly correlates to how smart your children are is stupid. And the idea that you have to have it and spend this exorbitant amount of money to be good at something, I mean, you look at us compared to other countries. Last year, I believe we ranked, 17th, 18th amongst other nations when it comes to kindergarten through 12th grade education. We spent way more money than every other country. I think it was four times as much as the first and second place country. And we're coming out 17th, really? The idea that spending more money equals more educated students is just stupid. And so they can make that case all they want to, but there's just nothing to it. And a lot of people will say that if you want to cut spending, that they actually want to cut spending, and they'll actually say, well, we want candidates that'll get the budget under control. We want candidates that are going to cut our taxes and cut our spending. And then when you actually start cutting some spending, they start freaking out. This is why it's so hard for real conservatives to win elections, because you're basically running against Santa Claus that's promising that you're going to get all this stuff and you're going to get it for free, and the only people that are going to pay for it are the people that make more than you. And when you're running against that, it's really hard to be the adult in the room and say, look, we can't afford all this extravagant stuff. We're going to have to cut some spending. When that takes place, it's really hard to do. And Matt Bevin learned that, just got a schooling in that, unfortunately. When you've got teachers unions, who, by the way, their primary concern is being good for the teachers and not for the students. And I know that firsthand from teachers that I am very close to in the public education system. The teachers union first responsibility is to the teachers, not the students, and to get as much money as possible for the teachers, not the students. It's sad, but it's true. And when Matt Bevin was saying we're going to have to cut some of the ridiculous benefits that we've been promising to teachers, they started freaking out and the wrath of that came down on them. They orchestrated a teacher strike. Now, it coincided with one in Oklahoma. And granted, the one in Oklahoma made a little bit more sense because Oklahoma really does have a funding issue. Kentucky, comparatively, they have nothing to complain about. And just seeing the fact that Bevin did that, like I said, it was like he was running against Santa Claus. He's trying to be the adult in the room saying, no, kids, we can't spend that. We can't, get an ice cream machine. We can't get a jet ski. I'm sorry, we just don't have the money for it. And this other guy's going, we can get all we want. We'll spend all the money that we want. We're going to increase spending on that. We're going to increase spending on this, and I'm not going to increase your taxes. Now, eventually, something's got to give because you're either increasing taxes or incurring debt somewhere. But the point is, that is why it's so very hard for any conservative to get elected. It's the reason that you're actually far better off doing what Kay Ivey does, which is promising that you're going to cut taxes and cut spending and then increasing them, but still talking a good game. Sadly, that's the winning strategy. Saying one thing and doing another. And comparing those two governors is a perfect example of that. Let's go on to the chaplain's report.
In 1775, the Continental Congress created the Chaplain Corps. Under the command of General George Washington, each soldier was required to attend worship service every Sunday. While other armies advanced on their feet, Washington's troops advanced on their knees. It's time for the Chaplain's Report with Caleb Colquitt on tactics.
Chaplain's Report today comes from the Psalms, and I thought it might be fun to do a little series on the 42nd Psalm, which is one that got really popular because there's a hymn that is based off of this psalm, which is funny because it's a song based on a song. But anyway, because that, of course, is what the Psalms are, right? They're the songbook of the Jewish people, essentially. And if sung in Hebrew, they actually do have melody and rhythm, and you can sing them. So in Psalm 42, we're going to go ahead because it's essentially broken into three verses, three segments. And we're going to go into depth. One thing that's important to note here is we don't actually know who the author of the 42nd Psalm is. We're just not sure about it. But a lot of people speculate, and this is a theory that I actually subscribe to, a lot of people speculate that it was David, and they speculate that this time took place when he was separated from Israel because of fleeing from Saul. And so we're going to discuss that, and we'll see some of the reasons why that speculation may very well be true. But let's go ahead and look at the first four verses of Psalm 42. As the deer pants for the water, brooks, so my soul pants for you, O God. My soul thirsts for God, for the living God. When shall I come and appear before God? My tears have been my food day and night, while they say to me all day long, where is your God? These things I remember, and I pour out my soul within me. For I used to go along with the throng, and lead them in procession to the house of God, with the voice of joy and thanksgiving, a multitude keeping festival. You can really see, in the symbolism and with the psalmist there just right out saying it, that the overarching idea here is a missing of God, a missing of God's presence. And the symbolism used there is really powerful because when a deer starts looking for water, they don't stop until they found it. When a deer is looking out some kind of, trying to find a source of water, They do so with eagerness, and they're, of course, overjoyed when they find it, because that was the thing that they needed, the thing that they were seeking after. And so the symbolism here is that that is the way that we ought to be seeking out God, that we should have a thirst. Our soul should be thirsty for God, for His word, for His precepts, His goodness. Those are all things that we should desire, just like a deer desires a drink of water when he is thirsty. And so in the same sense, this is the way that we ought to be seeking God every single day, that just like a deer, when all of a sudden it comes time and we know, hey, it's God time, whether it be a time of prayer or fasting or reading our scripture or going to worship service, that we are determined to get near God, and we do not stop until that need has been fulfilled. So there really is a lesson here in understanding the way that we ought to be seeking after God. And it's something that sometimes is difficult, sometimes is very easy. Sometimes we reach out to God almost instinctively, and sometimes it's very difficult to feel His presence. But regardless of what time that we're in, that desire is not something that should change. We should constantly be seeking after God and seeking to do His will. Now, the second part of this is that his soul is crying out for God's presence. Essentially, you think about it as just sort of a feral scream, that he's calling out to God, he's desperate, he wants God to be with him. This is, again, instructive for us as to how we should desire God. That whether it's a time of trouble or a time that we feel that we need God, or just because we are aware of how inadequate we are by ourselves, and because we want to be near God and have a communion with Him, our soul should be constantly crying out for God to be with us. We should want that kind of close-knit relationship with Him constantly. And that's the thing that the psalmist is trying to convey here. And because of that, you'll notice that he's talking about how he's been crying, that his tears have been his food all day and night, and that people have been saying to him, where is his God? So I think that it's really important that it hurts him that God is not with him. But I think another secondary point that's being made here is it also hurts him that other people can see that God is not with him. Now, maybe this is a time that the psalmist has been suffering some kind of great loss, or he has been engaged in some kind of sinful activity where he doesn't really feel God's presence, but it's also obvious to other people that God is not there with him. Now, there's a couple different ways to understand this. First of all, maybe the way that other people are noticing, where is your God, is because this was a upright, righteous man. Whoever it was, whether it was David or somebody else. And because of that, because some kind of rift has been created between him and God, this man is not himself. So in other words, this man, God was such an integral part of his life that they can tell, without him even bringing up the fact that he's going through something spiritually by his demeanor or his behavior, they're saying, something's off with this guy. He's not the way that he normally is. And the truth is, that's something that we should be striving for, isn't it? We should be a person that is known by others, whether they are fellow brothers and sisters in Christ or not, that if a rift is ever created between us and God, they immediately notice something's off with him. Because if we have a rift between God and nobody notices, it's a pretty good indication that we were never that close to God in the first place. If they can't really tell a difference between when we feel close to God and when we're not, then maybe that's because we're really not that different either way. That we were not that close to God before and we're not that close to God now, and because of that, it's not really noticeable to them. The second part of that, though, another way that they may know that God is, there's been some kind of distance created between the psalmist and God here, is that because he is somebody that seeks after God's presence, he's being vocal about it. In other words, he is letting other people know without them just noticing that God's presence is no longer felt by him. And because of that, other people are aware of that. And they're somewhat kind of even mocking, saying, where is your God? And we kind of get an indication of that. It would be something that would hurt you if they were mocking your pain. I don't know if that's the kind of idea we're supposed to get from this or not. It's just a secondary lesson that I think both of them actually work. But I think that one thing that could be going on with the psalmist here is that other people are mocking, saying, oh, where is your God to deliver you? Kind of the same way that we see in various other passages of the Old Testament, like Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, saying, where is your God now? Or when Christ was crucified, where is your God to rescue you now? We could see this almost happening in a mocking sense. And other people are onlooking and mocking whoever the psalmist is, saying, oh, where is your God now? He's clearly abandoned you. And then finally, this is a person that is accustomed to worship. Because you'll notice in the fourth verse there, he says, I used to go along with the throng and lead them in procession to the house of God. And he was talking about how joyful he was, how thankful he was for God's blessings at this point, which also leads us to believe that what is going on here is that this is a person that was a leader in worship, somebody that went with a large group of people, that it was well known that he was loved by the people in his congregation. This is something that's very likely. This is part of the reason we think it might be David. Because why would somebody be cut off from worship if they want God this badly? Well, a good answer would be, if it is David, and this is the time where he's either fleeing Absalom or fleeing Saul, when he's not able to go into the house of God and worship, he's lamenting that he no longer feels that connection to God like when he used to go out into the synagogue. And so, that's part of the reason we think it may be David, but whether it is or not, this is clearly a person that has a desire for worship, and this is something that I wish that more people in the church had. It's something that, on occasion, I really wish that I had, because normally I'm really excited to go to church. There are times where I'm not. There are times where I feel like I don't need to be at worship. I feel like I'm either ashamed of something that I've done, or I don't know, that there's that rift that's been created. And what I love about the attitude in this psalm is, no, that's the time you need God the most. That's the time where your soul should be crying out. That's the time where you should want to be in worship the most. And maybe that's what's going on here. Regardless of who the psalmist is, and I tend to think that it's David, but it doesn't say, and we're not necessarily sure. But no matter who it is, this is clearly a man that has a thirst and hunger for God's presence in his life, and that is something that all of us should be emulating. Stay the course, friends.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.